Escape from Plan A.
Escape. Escape. Escape.
From Plan A.
Welcome, listeners, to this episode of Escape from Plan A, a very special episode because we are up all in the Catskills. And we have Jess with us live in person.
Jess in New York.
New York. This is a very special thing because we don't know when we'll get another chance for this to happen. Maybe Jess will relocate to New York for some reason, but I think that's the best hope we have. So we just want to take advantage of the situation while we're up here in this cabin. Heat's down, by the way, so Jess and I are huddled in blankets. Teen seems fine right now, but who knows what'll happen at night. We're going to huddle around the fire. Got some space heaters. No hot water either, so I'm going showerless all weekend.
Yep, it's the real experience. It's kind of strange. I've never actually talked to you guys in person before.
Yeah.
You mean together?
Like together, yeah. Like we've never been like looking at each other eye to eye. While we do a pod.
Do a pod, yeah.
Yeah, Jess, your voice sounds exactly the same, but seeing you in person is another step.
Yeah, so this will be fun.
Yeah, so
we've hung out in LA plenty of times.
Yeah, we hang out, right? Yeah. But like the podcast experience where I'm like actually looking a human and being in the eye, as opposed, like I usually pod in a really cramped, tiny space. I'm looking at like a wall that's like 5 inches in front of me. Yeah.
Yeah, so this, I want to call these our Catskill sessions. I don't know how many of
these. Oh, that sounds so official, man.
It'll be lost tapes of Plan A.
Like 5 years, we release the remaster. Yeah.
So this episode, we've been thinking about doing this for a while, but, you know, we haven't been able to coordinate it. But it's been almost exactly 2 years since I published my article, What If Asian American Men Fall to the Alt-Right, which I just checked. It was published on September 19th, 2017.
So about 2 years, 1 month.
Yeah, 2 years, yeah. 1 month. And it was our first article that got a lot of readers, thanks to our, I don't know, a frenemy, Elleg.
Oh, yeah.
We have a convoluted history with that. I don't know what he's up to these days. Wish him all the best. But he shared it on his Facebook page. So that was our first taste of what it was like to get a sudden mass amount of readers. Not that our other articles didn't also get a lot of readers, but this one just took off the gate. And there was a lot of pushback from the start. Do you guys remember that?
I do, yeah.
Yeah.
I remember how seriously we took it, too. We're like, oh, shit. We've got to address these point by point.
Yeah.
In one of the Facebook groups, Jen Fang had a wall of text in which she said she was like seriously disturbed and supremely disappointed in my article. And then there were other people who expressed similar thoughts.
Do you remember if she explained why?
Well, pretty much because the gist of my article was that there was like the current Asian American liberalism as it stood left out a lot of people, one among being Asian American men, and she took that to mean that it's like the whole, well, then you're just like a men's rights movement kind of thing.
And yeah, but that's what you were addressing.
Right, and that's what I was addressing, and my whole point was, no, we can't let these guys fall to that, which was the whole title of my article. But I think what it showed was that with Asian Americans, there is this a lot of anxiety about there's this limited space in which we're allowed to form some kind of political consciousness. And if there's only space for like one. So even if we agree on 90% of the things, we differ on 10%, even just a healthy disagreement threatens them because there can only be one. So if it's not them, then it's going to be us. So I think that it portrayed a lot of that anxiety because I think Asian Americans feel like there's only so much attention and funds that can go around. And if any other group does not fall lockstep with them, then they are a threat to their position.
In a weird way, I can actually relate to that because 2 years ago, I would say it just felt a lot more urgent that I felt a lot more urgency in making sure that the things that we wanted to say got heard or got out there. I don't know if I quite feel the same urgency anymore, but at that time, for some reason, I do remember thinking like, someone needs to say this. And I don't know, maybe it's like 2 years on, I kind of feel like either we said it or a lot of other people said similar things. And I feel like now is, if you follow the online Asian American discussion, it's evolved a lot, I think, in the past 2 years.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think 2 years ago, yeah, there was a mood in the air where it just felt very necessary to try to break down problems very methodically and with some amount of seriousness. Like, even bad faith arguments felt important to break down. 2 years in, I don't care as much about that anymore. It's like 2 years of the same back. It's the exact same back and forth. It's not like the issues have really changed all that much. And if you look at the bottom, if you look at the lower levels of the discourse, it's really the same thing over and over and over again. That's been my frustration with it.
Oh, so you're saying it hasn't actually evolved. It's just been stuck in the same loop.
I think so.
Yeah, I can see that too.
I think it's now the same issue, but now there's more collective fatigue over it, which actually has the negative effect of reinforcing very tired people to still stand for the same things. Like, the people who were interested in this but kind of got to some resolution and bounced, they're no longer involved in this discussion. So it's still, so everybody who graduates just leaves. So it still leaves this like concentrated soup of very low level, emotionally driven, anger-driven dialogue.
I think that's our next challenge. Something I want to talk about with this pod is, we've been doing this for 2 years, and when we started, what really excited us was we're talking about all these things that nobody else is talking about, whether it's like gender issues, the lack of genuine like Asian American political consciousness that's not just piggybacking off of existing movements. And those are the things that really animated us. I think 2 years from now, I think it has become much more mainstream within Asian American people, that the stuff we talked about 2 years ago, which seems so radical that you had someone like Jen Feng come out against us the instant we started Plan A, because September 19th, I think we published our first article in like August 22nd or 23rd. So that was like a few weeks after we started, and then we were attacked right out of the gate. But the stuff we said then is now probably being said by NPR, NBC, you go to these things and you see it much more mainstreamed.
You're talking about like mostly especially the gender.
Yeah, especially the gender stuff. Yeah. You see it on, the NPR Invisibility episode, the New York Times Modern Love article that came out that we potted about. So all this stuff has, I think, become much more acceptable to talk about. So in our position now, we're thinking of, well, what's the next step? And Jess, I think what you were talking about is, since we don't know what that next step is, a lot of the people who graduate, so to speak, we don't know where to go. So they might drop out or wander around. And then it's the people who are still at the entry level who have a more of a structure to work with.
Yeah.
So I think that's our responsibility now. So what is that next step?
See, I don't know.
None of us know.
I know.
That thing.
Yeah. But I mean, it's the same thought process, right? Like, what are the problems that are on our minds, right? Like, what do we end up talking about more and more? Like, we've been talking with each other. I've known you guys for years at this point. I think part of that is kind of coming to an understanding, a more nuanced understanding. So it's no longer like me, Jess, just this random stranger on the internet, engaging with Chris, who's like the archetype for all, say, Asian American men on the internet, right? I'm just Jess. I'm not a stand-in for all Asian American women on the internet. Once you kind of break that, I feel like when we talk online, we do resort to relying on archetypes to kind of fill in our understanding of what people are like. And this is how it gets ad hominem so quickly. Like, you disagree, and then right away off the gate, it's because you're a man and you're embroiled in toxic masculinity, and you want, you're on a campaign to try to, you only want to topple white supremacy so you can overtake them in the positioning. It gets really heated really, really quickly because we're relying on stereotypes, basically, that we've constructed in our head. So part of me kind of wonders if this fatigue is just, it's more of a personal one rather than like a generalized one. Like, just me personally, I have come to understand and know so many different perspectives that it's no longer possible or I can't do it in good faith to just boil people down to some respective collection of identities that stand for some political messaging, right? So in that sense, like, I've come to just some personal, like, acceptance of what these issues are. But I, the more I think about it, the more, some, for some of these, there is no real call to action. I think that's where some of the discourse goes astray, because we talk about these in terms of the problems, and it's inevitable that you would think that if you're talking about a problem, you are trying to also concoct a conclusion, some call to action that you want other people to be engaged on with you. For some of these issues that we talk about, there is no real, there isn't a single unified call to action that's even possible. So it feels irresponsible to try to be always thinking about, like, this is what you should do. If you think this is a problem, this is what, how you need to think about it. This is what you need to do in your personal life. It's feeling more and more irresponsible to even try to convince someone of that. So for me, the struggle is then I'm just really talking as a single person. I just don't know how to think about these problems in a way that's divorced from necessarily immediately hopping to some solution that we want people to be engaged in.
Yeah, I agree with that. I mean, I think for me, I am more interested in more personal stories these days.
Yeah. Yeah. Same.
Yeah. And like, to me, it's also like a lot of the racial issues are more embedded into how you just function, like how you think as a person. You may not even know whether it's related or not. But I think one thing I do see is that sometimes I feel that the things that people are saying about being Asian, yeah, I think people tend to archetype what they're saying in a way. And they selectively reveal certain details about their life.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't see the whole story, right?
They're very, very telling. Exactly what you decide to throw at someone. It's pretty telling of their own psychology and coming in.
Yeah, it just feels kind of incomplete. And I think part of it is why I don't feel that there's a lot of like Asian American writers or personalities that are really grabbing me in a way, which I wish I would see more of. Because even if I read like a white or a black or a Latino author that is super interesting to me, there's still part of me, I was like, I wish I was reading this from an Asian person. So I'd like to, that's kind of what I've been looking for, which is why, you know, how like we're basically potting for articles, right? I guess Oxford for me, like, I do think I'm still more interested in like what we can do in terms of getting people to write, and just like quality of writing. Yeah.
What do you see as a difference between, say, why particularly writing as opposed to other forms of media?
I don't know. Just because it's harder to do. And when it's done well, you know, I don't know. Like, I just feel like it's more valuable if writing is done well and you just feel compelled to read something. I just don't feel compelled to read a lot of Asian American authors.
Yeah. There's a permanence to writing that's helpful.
Yeah.
Because you can always go back to it. Whereas how many of us listen to a podcast episode more than once? Like, very rarely. I can't even think of maybe like one episode in all the podcasts I've ever listened to. I might listen to it more than once. Mm-hmm. It's hard to go back and quote it. It's hard to, even sharing it with someone, you're asking someone to invest like an hour or maybe even 2 hours of their time to maybe get to a point that is not heard until like minute 51, you know, 26 seconds in. Mm-hmm. Whereas with an article, you can just say, okay, hey, check this out, you know, copy paste, and it spreads like that. And so I think that is the value of writing. That's also the downside of writing, that it is more permanent. So you better know what you're writing about, because it can be thrown back against you. So you got to be able to express yourself pretty well. And I think that does make people pull back sometimes from writing, where they're like, okay, I'm not 100% sure on this. I might blurt it out on a podcast because no one will probably remember it. But when I write it, I better know it 200%. And since I don't know it like that, I'm going to soft pedal it, and then you end up with a more generic, like, am I Asian? Am I American? You know, those type of pieces, which don't say anything. And they get published because, hey, it's like Asian American Pacific Heritage Month or whatever. And that seems acceptable, fills a quota, but it doesn't say anything.
I'm curious in why we say the things we do and what we don't say. I've just been thinking about, you know, the tropes that you see constantly in Asian American literature and just like journalism. Oh, I don't know what that genre of writing is. You know, like not quite an op-ed, not quite a journalistic piece, not quite like memoir, like a personal essay that's still kind of directional. Is there a name for that genre?
Are you talking about like the whole like first person kind of thing? I know that gets attacked a lot because they think it's exploitative, especially of young women.
Mm-hmm.
Ooh, like right about that time, you almost got sexually assaulted because it titillates readers, and it doesn't really say anything in terms of politics. It's just like somebody's sex story, and it's essentially what you might read, almost what you might read in like an old penthouse letter. Mm-hmm. But they dress it up as something that's more respectable. But it targets that same part of the brain that why they would read something like a penthouse letter.
Mm-hmm. I guess I'm curious. So why collectively we focus on these very relatively narrow issues to stand in as representative whole?
What's an example? Like, what are you talking about?
The stinky lunch genre of writing. Okay. I know that's not the. That's just what I call it. Like, it's basically you see a piece by an Asian American, and the odds are pretty good at one point if it's kind of autobiographical, they're going to talk about that time someone called their lunch stinky and got bullied over. This is just like a cornerstone of being Asian American. Like, I never experienced that as a kid, but I have come to know that if you are Asian American, that's your shit. You just have to own that your lunches are not accepted in the mainstream, right? So basically, if you're Asian American, like I feel like everyone just kind of knows this story, right? Yellow fever is another big one, mm-hmm. right? What's another one that we like? War trauma.
I think that's
Where are you from? Yeah. Where are you really from? Right, that's the third one.
Cultural appropriation.
Cultural appropriation is a relatively new but strong contender.
I didn't grow up seeing anybody that looked like me on television.
Yeah. Usually around anytime there's any Asian face in some
it's
media.
Done. I mean, it's like I don't think any of us are saying that stuff is invalid or wasn't worth saying, but it's been done.
And it's so evergreen. I kept, like, you know, when Crazy Rich Asians came out, we had a pretty fairly big wave of ground up, you know, work being done by Asian Americans. Yet it's still, you know, relying on these same touchstones to find common ground. Like, one thing that I found really interesting, like you and I talked about this, Teen, is why Better Luck Tomorrow has completely fallen out of Asian American collective consciousness.
Well, it was ranked the best Asian American movie by the LA Times, but there were a lot of movies there which were more like the type that film critics would love, but the average Asian American has probably never seen.
Mm-hmm.
So it was ranked number one, but chances are the average Asian American probably has barely heard of it, or if they've heard of it, they've never actually watched it.
Yeah, I'm saying, like, when Crazy Rich Asians came out, there were so many, like, congratulatory pieces saying, this is the first major, like, studio release since Joy Luck Club. You know, it's been 25 years since we had a movie with an all-Asian cast. And, like, in that mentioning, like, Better Luck Tomorrow just falls out of collective consciousness. And my theory is that it just doesn't fit the narrative that Asian Americans have created for themselves. I know there's a lot of ink spilled about how we are boxed in, but I think we have agency in a lot of that too, because we keep relying on the same tropes to like build the collective consciousness. This is just the Asian American brand. Our lunches stink, our women are hot, our stuff is kind of cool.
So what do you want to see?
Anything different, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not really proposing anything. I'm just wondering what in these subjects are so deep that they keep having to be revisited.
Just to
wrap up the point, like every time you see a piece like this, like I think there was one, it was beautifully written. It was a woman, I think she's half Asian, Her Korean mother passed away, and it's about her breaking down in the middle of an H Mart, right?
Oh, like, that's the Japanese breakfast essay in The New Yorker, I think.
Yeah, beautifully written.
Frankly, just like the synopsis of it just sounds nauseating, but go ahead.
I mean, it was sad. I mean, it's real, right? I felt for her, and that, you know, that genuinely was a moving story.
Was that the one about H Mart?
Yeah, like, yeah. She was like breaking down in H Mart because, you know, food was her connection to her culture through her mother. She doesn't have a connection through her father, and so when she passed away, it's like something real got severed. I understand that, and I feel for that. But like the way it was received, it was like it was the first one that had ever been written on this subject. Pretty reliably. Okay, if I were to write and I wanted to maximize views, I would pretty much just combine Stinky Lunch and Yellow Fever. This would rock. You could get a lot of clicks on this, right? But I can't believe that this is the sum total of Asian American consciousness. Yeah. I can't believe that. I'm just curious what draws these creatives to sit down and dedicate a portion of their lives to creating a piece based on this, and it's the same thing over and over again.
I think, like, just thinking about that as you raised it, these just sound like children's narratives, right? It's about
developmental narratives.
It's like, yeah, you know, please like my food, because like the whole Asian Stinky Lunch thing, that did not become popular until like Asian food became quite accepted in mainstream society. So ultimately, what you're asking for is not that radical. You're asking for this kind of retroactive apology for something that mainstream society now really likes. Because it's not challenging. It's not like saying, you will now accept this food that you still actually hate. It's actually what you love now. Same thing with Yellow Fever. Ultimately, it's about a type of sexual attraction that mainstream America likes. It's not saying, it's not challenging them to like something that they find repulsive. They like it. And, you know, ultimately, what's the message of like the Stinky Lunch thing? It's like, you know, please accept our food. With the Yellow Fever, it's like, please
accept our humanity or something.
Yeah, most of these articles are not like, and this is why I don't, you know, literally fuck with white men. It's always usually, can you be nicer to us? You know, like, we really can't stop, you know, wanting you, so can you please want us in a, you know, slightly better way? It's very supplicating. It's like a children to parent narrative, and I think that's why it's very pleasing for the wider audience.
I agree with that. I think they're actually, it's pretty insidious, because these are they're promoted and talked about as empowerment, right? As if just the fact that it appeared in the New Yorker is, it should be like, we should collectively be adding plus one to our like points tally in society. Like, we've gone up one point as a result of some Asian person publishing a piece in the New Yorker. And it's about how they were bullied as a kid for their stinky lunches. But in sum total, to me, that's pretty insidious, because these are pity narratives.
Exactly.
I think you're right to use that word, supplicating. It's supplicating and appeasing to a greater power. These are narratives that are soothing and kind of congratulatory and kind of works the right instinct in say white people. I mean, these are all published in pieces that are predominantly white, liberal, moneyed, and white. So I think when I say something different, it's can we think about this in a way that isn't fundamentally about seeking pity or seeking to tickle the pity nerve or the noblesse oblige instinct. I really hate those pieces, the ones that are created to lay out, you know, I'm a boat my parents were boat people, we settled here, we worked hard, you know, we got bullied for being lower income or something, and it's all about, it's a terrible story, but if you're, but the person that they're rewind. I feel like if they're talking about oppressions that they have faced, they're still expecting that the audience is able to distance themselves from that oppressor, right? We were bullied by these other kinds of people, not as liberal as you, not as sympathetic or good as you guys are. We are looking to you guys to help validate that. And so it really just furthers a very white liberal mission to just distance themselves from the unwashed trailer park hicks. You know, the Trump voters, the MAGA people, those bad guys. It's not fundamentally designed to reshape any kind of narrative. Hmm. So I have a hard time with Asian American media, honestly, because of that.
Yeah, so bringing it back to the first thing we mentioned, which was my alt-right article, what do you guys think is the type of article that would break those tired old supplicating narratives and do something that's brash and bold? Like, Teen, do you have an idea of what you were looking for? You said something like that's more personal, but somebody writing that could argue, hey, that's very personal for me, and he or she's probably right, but it's a boring kind of personal. So what's like exciting personal to you?
I'm not, I think I'm looking for, in terms of like what I want to read, like when I say I'm looking for something, it's like, I just have this itch to find something where when my eyes hit the page, I just feel compelled to finish it. And I think what I'm looking for is actually maybe someone who can actually, not someone who can I can relate to through something like Stinky Lunch or whatever. I'm actually looking for someone who has thought things through way more than I have, that has like a personality or a worldview that's like more integrated than what I've got. Like, I want to learn something from their perspective. I don't want to just relate. I think a lot of those articles that we've been talking about are about, hey, we're all Asian, and one of the things that we all have gone through is being teased about having stinky lunches. And even though that's never happened to me, somehow I can relate, right? Because I feel sorry for them or whatever. But what do I learn from that? Not much. So I'm looking for someone... I'm looking for people who write something where I'm just learning something. I'm getting, you know, there's like there's little epiphanies in what they're saying. I just don't see a lot of that.
I guess it would have to be forward facing. Like, these narratives, they're still past. They're still about the past. Some damage that occurred in childhood or adolescence, and you as an adult are kind of grappling with that now. These are all trying to make kind of sense of some things that already happened in the past. I think the things that excite me most is someone who can use that to kind of to be a little bit more forward-facing. Like, I always know it really annoys the crap out of me that all these, so many pieces just end with, and this is why we need more conversation. Like, asshole, I thought I was having that with you. Right? You just contextualize. You just spent like 300 words to tell me how we need to have a conversation. Like, no, you could have had that. Yeah.
I will admit that a lot of my early articles, and hell, maybe even my later ones, I haven't reread a lot of my stuff, I did end with something like that. And I think that's a reason why, to be honest, the last couple of months I have been wondering, well, what is our next step? Because we hit our 2-year anniversary. And my thought is, if in a year we're still doing the same thing as we're doing now, but, you know, kind of like bigger and better, maybe we're getting more views on our articles or more listens on our pods, I think we'll have failed. We got to find whatever it is that's next. And I think the reason is that when we started off saying that, let's have a conversation, felt very new, felt very exciting.
It was.
You know, we've met a lot of people in real life. Like, before we did Plan A, it was very rare for me to meet up with someone off the internet. I still felt a little weird doing that. Now, it feels like
standard
I do,
MO.
I feel like I do it every day. Not every day. Like, every week, maybe.
All the time.
Secrets out. Plan A was Oxford's Tinder all along. That's just, cat's out of the bag.
We're meeting with all sorts of different people. You know, politicians. You know, sex worker activists, writers. You know, film people. Like, disgruntled tech people, all sorts of people, men, women, you know, all sorts of Asian.
All with super interesting points of view.
Also,
super interesting people.
So I feel like, yeah, we've got this conversation started. And I was talking about this with Anton. Anton was on our very excellent Hapa Men podcast a few episodes back, which you should listen to if you haven't. He and I were talking. In my, you know, like, daily perusal of Asian Reddit, I found this post in one of them, in which it was like a confessions from Berkeley, you know, one of those Facebook groups. It was by a young Asian woman, and she was saying how she was tired of criticism from all these super sensitive liberals who were criticizing her preference for white guys, and she was kind of sarcastically apologizing. I'm sorry that I was raised with only images of, you know, desirable white men and all that. And Anton and I were just discussing this, and hey, wait a minute. what's really different is that in the past, she would have said, I'm tired of all these criticism from all these super backwards, conservative, race purists, whatever. But she was actually criticizing people from the left, criticizing her for that. Mm-hmm. And if that's how the discussion has gotten, I think like that's kind of what we wanted, right? We were just saying, hey, like, we don't really care what you do, but let's just talk about it from a more honest angle. So if that's what's happening in Berkeley in 2019 among undergrads, it does make what we set out to do like 2 years ago seem like it's somewhat accomplished. And I think that's why we're feeling a little restless.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, 2 years ago, it was still a struggle to break apart the conservative versus liberal binary, because right, it was right. still very much you don't sound like this, therefore you must be that.
Yeah.
Talking about, say, liberal hypocrisy, liberal racism, you know, bullshit caused, you know, caused and propagated by people on the left, that was still very much a an underground. Like, you could only really. I could only really talk about that with like close friends. Like if I said that out loud or in any kind of setting, that isn't just like people who absolutely know me, they would immediately, you know, jump to some conclusions that would be completely wrong about who I am and what I stand for. 2 years in, I think, you know, just watching Trump melt down, but also watching how, you know, the completely ineffective liberal response to that has, I think it's opened a lot of people's eyes to just how, to the rottenness of the system itself. So I actually see a lot more people starting to critique, you know, starting to look, zoom a little bit out. They're not talking about just, you know, Trump or, you know, Clinton. They're not talking about individual agents anymore. Now we are actually talking about, like, what was wrong with this entire system that led to this conclusion. I think that's a step in the right direction. We're not, like, we're not hyper-personalizing this anymore. We're actually starting to see how there's a whole infrastructure in place that that perpetuates and incentivizes certain kinds of behavior that only manifests in individuals that are selected in a system. So as far as like Asian Americans go, I don't think we're behind the ball.
No, like, do you guys get that sense? I totally agree.
So there's a whole like art class of like journalists yeah. and thinking heads, and there's always a sense that we are like three steps behind where right. some bastion of progressivism is, mm-hmm. and our struggle is that is to try to overcome that delta between us and them. It's always assumed that there's always they are always three.
It's
steps
a hand
ahead.
Me down, yeah. Vision of race.
Yeah, so right. it, you know, as far as they feel this responsibility to be educating the rest of us unwashed yellow masses, right, to close that gap. That's the completely wrong way to talk about this, because I think in a lot of ways we were ahead of that conversation. And I think pieces like yours were actually way ahead of its time.
Why, thank you.
Well, it was. I mean, that's why we're friends, buddy. right? It's talking about like, okay, as an Asian American man, you did root this in your own, you know, subjectivity as an Asian American man. None of us are pretending that we're some like outside impartial observer. We're actually contextualizing this in our own subjectivities, but you're using this to say like, look, based on that and my good judgment, this is a big problem spot that nobody is properly addressing. Through this lens in particular, you can speak with particular intelligence and integrity on, say, Asian American men, but nothing in that article is necessarily just specific to Asian Americans or Asian American men. This is really saying, look, given this landscape, we're going to have this big blind spot that a shit ton of people, vulnerable people, particularly men, are going to fall into, and this is going to be a problem for everyone. 2 years in, what do we see? We see that exact same debate happening on a much larger scale.
What in your... that's interesting, and I think I agree with a lot of that, but that's a general statement. What do you think is it about Asian American people that puts them ahead in a way? I can see how right now, post-Trump, that the world has... That America, but the world too, has really opened up in a weird way. Not opened up, but a lot of a lot of assumptions, a lot of political assumptions, social assumptions about by people have fallen apart, and that leaves the field fairly wide open, in my opinion. And so I do believe that wide open field that Asian people in America have certain can be seen as ahead in certain ways. But what do you think it is?
Well, The kind of the way to talk about that that's kind of hip with liberal take on it is, oh, we have a history of oppression, right? Mm-hmm. We all have a history, a pretty fairly recent one, of colonialism, oppression, all these social oppressions. That's not the whole story, though. I think one of the things that sets us ahead of the curve, if we are able to leverage it, is a pretty dark one. Like Asian Americans very recently have now been shown to have the largest wealth gap in America. We beat white people by a fair margin. So in terms of the scale of the issues that we face as a community, this is actually magnified even more so than white people, right? How we are able to talk about, say, class, money, aspiration, right, is where the conversations I can have with other Asian Americans who do think deeply about this is so far ahead of the curve on what I can hear from anyone else. And I think it's the fact that, one, this for Asians and Asian Americans, this all happened really quickly. Like within my parents' generation and mine, we have 150 years of history that the West has gone through compressed into maybe 50. And I think that comes with some experience in how to talk about these things too. Like I've been to Korea in the '80s. You know, I still remember that time. I remember.
Oh really?
I was very very young, but it was that traumatic.
Late '80s, right?
Like '89, yeah. Right? But it's like going out and visiting very distant relatives, and like they didn't have indoor plumbing. Right?
Oh, yeah, I remember Taiwan in the mid-'80s, which followed Korea fairly closely in terms of
development. Right. This was Seoul.
No, this was way outside Seoul. I have no idea what we were doing there, honestly. Okay. But like we just like visited, and like they were explained to be family, and we're just visiting them. They didn't have indoor plumbing, right? So I'm literally watching them pump water, like bring it in with pails, and there's an outhouse, and that was a whole traumatic experience of its own. But like I remember that this is within living memory, watching Korea go from that to the like a global power on its own, right? And being Asian American, you bring all that with you. Mm-hmm. And the way we have to talk about it, like look, like just amongst ourselves, right? How many conversations have we had? Like we need to be careful about how we talk about these things and who we are speaking to and why. Look, all of us come from such radically different places. And if you look at even just the numbers, just the wealth gap alone says a ton about the incredible variability in the experiences at the very top of this food chain and the very bottom. What we see is think pieces written from a very, very narrow stratum of that diversity. And that's supposed to be, that's held up as the ideal. Everyone is actually supposed to aspire to this roughly middle class, aspirational American dream kind of class positioning. That's obviously not true.
Yeah, and I think that's why it is. If I had to say it, it would probably be, you know, like middle class or at least aspiring middle class, very well educated, mm-hmm. East Asians.
That's a big one too.
Right. And I think the people doing that know it, and which is why you constantly see these allegations of especially like anti-blackness, like the favorite nuclear weapon used by like online Asian activists, writer types. And I think it's precisely because they know that their point of view is a very limited one, and in order to protect their position, they can't seem like the elite. So they're always accusing other Asians. Especially the ones who are less assimilated, less come from, you know, they're the types who don't go to the elite university, probably go to the local like state schools and stuff like that. Those types of people are constantly branded as anti-black or, homophobic, all like the negative stereotypes that white people often use against lower class white people. You see Asians replicating exactly the same within our own community.
Yeah, and I would also say that one way that, like, look, people talk about white adjacency a ton, right? And usually the way the conversation goes is it's people pointing fingers at each other. You're white adjacent. No, you're white adjacent. That comes with some power. Like, if you just cut the bullshit, yeah, a lot of us are very white adjacent. we are witness to a lot of shit that goes on behind the scenes. We're not just victims of the system. We are active participants at every stratum of society, right from the very top. We have Asians like Elaine Chao. We have people walking the very highest seats of the halls of power right down to the very least empowered. So I think there's a real opportunity there for people, for Asian Americans who are inside the system to actually talk. I think that's one of the appeals of these personal narratives that come out, right? It's like saying I am an insider. If I just laid out my resume, you would have this certain impression of who I am and what I stand for. But here I am talking from behind that curtain and showing you what it actually is. Calling out the BS that we all face, but using that subject. I think we have a very unique subjectivity where we're close to power. Some of us have access to quite a bit of it, more than we would like to admit, maybe sometimes. And it's very powerful to me to actually have people who are in those positions, or people who I would think are in those positions, come out and just say, like, no, this is nothing like what you are being led to believe. This is like, this is not an enviable position, or, you know, just, or even just saying, like, you know what?
We've heard more and more of that recently, too. People in tech, especially, coming out and sort of blowing the whistle on, you know, just how corrupting and exploitative an environment big tech can be.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the other part of it, and we talk about we have pretty unique or well-developed subjectivities, that's what I want to see. I want to see what people really think. And one of the things that I've felt... and I've come to understand more about myself is like I'm inescapably like a Chinese person. It's very hard to say that even now. And I think that part of it is this Asian American complex about not being able to assimilate or not be, you know, like the whole racial melancholia. And how we're essentially stuck in this, you know, asymptotic approach towards whiteness and whatever. And as true as that may be in terms of, you know, causing a lot of like personality disorders and problems in people, I feel like things are different now. I just don't think there is a clear idea of what whiteness is and what it means to approach it. And so I think in a way what I've seen online more is more and more of a sort of Asian discourse, not just Asian American, not just problems unique to, you know, Asian people in America or whatever, but sort of a global diaspora, and increasingly more so often people in Asia itself who've never left to some degree, though mm-hmm. there's still language barriers and stuff like that. But I'm starting to see that what I'd like to see more of as well are Asian Americans writing as Asians.
Mm-hmm.
Not Asian Americans writing about the difficulties in being counterfeit Americans. And I think now is a good time to do that because, going back to your article about the alt-right, even the alt-right folks are trying to look towards Asia.
Yeah.
Right? To, you know what I'm saying? And so I'm just starting to feel like there's a new concept. There's a new, especially with the internet and how much of this stuff happens online, that the idea of Asian American is not as interesting as it was to me before. I think the idea of being an Asian living in America is more descriptive of like my experience of life.
Right. And that's like the Asian American nightmare though, right? That the Asian Americanness.
I think it was the nightmare.
But see how rotten the American side of that is, right? You hear a really cringy conversation, right? And you're like, thank God for whatever combination of subjectivities I have that makes me not as stupid as you just sounded.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I think like there's some there, I think Americans are really naive about a lot of things. And one of the things that they are very naive about is just how they come across. Like they don't have this conception of being like, it's like, yeah, America, fuck yeah. So they say whatever they want. And then if you take a step back and just actually critically examine it, that was a dumb thing to say. That shows an incredible amount of just sheer naivete about how the world works and how human nature works and how your position is not what you think it is. I think we have a unique ability to be able to see that, to be close to that, to understand it from their side, but then also to be able to say, this is not how I want to live my life.
Mm-hmm. Like, or it's not how I'm living my life.
It's not.
Anyway, that's just not how I do
it. It's not possible. But and I think melancholy is about the impossibility of that aspiration, right? That I want to live like that. But I think the new door that's opening is kind of shining a critical light on this thing that we are all kind of, that we were all kind of led to believe we wanted to aspire to, and seeing like that's not, that actually may not have ever existed. And if it did, it's not something we should be going for.
I suspect that it's been this way all along. I can't know, I don't know for sure, but I know for me, and I've said this before, that when it came to being Chinese American, it was the American side of it that I always felt was subordinate. Like that was the part that kind of bothered me. Mm-hmm. And I feel actually that that's a more I suspect that that's a more universal feeling than we think. And I think if you look at the way you see a lot of people in like subtle Asian groups in Facebook and others are talking about being Asian, there is a built-in sense of both pride and loss. Like they're hanging on to they're trying to be as connected as they can possibly be to their homeland, to the culture in the homeland, and to try and bring that with them over here. And I think part of the, say, those things about the stinky lunch and whatever, and also even racial melancholia to some degree, I think was driven by the loss of your Asian-ness, not necessarily, oh, I so want to be like white people, because honestly, in my life, I haven't met many, quote, white-worshipping people. Even the ones that from, if you didn't know them from afar, you might consider them white worshiping. If you know them, and I'm sure we all know people like this, I don't think that actually describes that. I think it's Asian people kind of realizing that they don't want to lose that. But then the sort of pain of living within sort of like a white hegemonic culture that has no value on that connection. And that's changing. I think that's what's changing.
I think so too. Yeah, just to go back to like the stinky lunch genre, right? Mm-hmm. The conclusion for this is to me it's a little weak, right? It's just don't make fun of me anymore. Like they can go either one of two ways, right? Okay, you bullied, you dumbass hicks don't know what good food is, so you gave me a hard time for it and I had no backup, so this stung and I was a child. Okay, fast forward some. Now, like, then it's like, well, what do you want from these people in that case, right? On the one hand, it's just don't make fun of it anymore, or, like, accept it. The other hand is just leave me alone, right? And I wonder if you present these two options to people, how many would, which one would they rather take? My guess is actually, like, according to the collective narrative, we would all kind of have to say, like, people just want to be accepted, like, assimilation. They want to just have the roadblocks to assimilation removed, and they just, you know, walk off into the white sunset, and just that's it, right? There's another take you could go from there. It's like, you guys have no taste, and you're mean. Leave me the fuck alone so I can just do what I want.
I think that's what the stinky lunch genre really is. If you read, I think a lot of this stuff can be reread in a way that's more interesting than it comes across.
Yeah.
Because I think the stinky lunch thing came out in response to white hipsters suddenly discovering your food.
Do you think so? Because I feel like I've been reading this since like the 90s.
But I feel like a lot of the same Asian writers who write that are pretty much from that same group anyway.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that they what I'm saying is it can be reread in a way.
It can be. So that would be something different. I would love to read it with that stronger angle.
Right.
Yeah, my take on it being, let me explain what I think you can reread it as, which is that I think, and there are two of them that were written in the Washington Post that was particularly good. I can dig up the links and stuff. But it was about, oh, suddenly you've discovered the stuff that was in my mom's kitchen, and now you think you've Columbused it or whatever. But you were the same person that was sort of, you know, teasing me when I was a kid for it. It's easy, I think, to read that as sort of just being salty and upset about having been teased by white people. But I think part of it also, and I don't know whether it was intentionally written into the article, but I suspect what was driving it to an extent was this idea of like, now you fucking see.
Yeah.
Like now you get why we do what we do, right? But you think you know, but I'm telling you, you still don't know. Just because suddenly you think kimchi's great doesn't mean you know shit about being Korean, right? Just because all of a sudden you've discovered Sichuan peppercorns doesn't mean suddenly you get me. There's still a lot of shit about me and my family and stuff that you have no idea about. You don't understand. I think there was a little bit of defensiveness to it, and I kind of encouraged that a little.
No, I agree. Yeah, me too. My distrust is just that the type of people who write it, because of, you know, whether the schools or the programs or the crowds they run in. What that sounds like to me is, you can't replace me in your social circle. I am still your token Asian in your, you know, little social group. And their main problem with the appropriation thing is it takes away what makes them valuable to the group.
But I agree. I mean, I do agree with that. But I think that there is in that, if you reread it in the way of saying...
Right. If you just like erase who wrote it and just read it for what it was without... Yeah. What you think they came from? Yeah, for sure. You can take...
But also that I think out of whatever motivated him to write that, that I think that's present in a lot of people, a lot of Asian people. And I'd like to maybe, to the extent that we still want to develop, say, new goals for Plan A, that's one of the things that I want people to do, is to take their own Asianness more seriously rather than constantly seeing their Asianness as... something that they would like to either get over or you know, to feel hyper defensive about. Just feel a sense of maybe gratitude that you even have that connection. Because I think one thing that I do see, and this was embedded, I think, within that alt-right article as well, is that connection is something that I think a lot of white Americans don't have in their life and are desperate for it.
They find
keep trying to throw it away.
Yeah. I mean, what was the big thing with the alt-right? You know, these ridiculous attempts by white people to like find their one Viking ancestor, right? Reconnect with their Celt. Like there's a whole paganism revival going on in these circles. Like Odinists are throwing festivals, right? So I think... Like there's just always this tendency in America to think of America as the gold standard for how people should live and what value society should hold, right? Everyone else is kind of behind, or that's the social experiment. These are just various social experiments that are fraying to varying degrees. And so they're distanced from the American ideal that determines how much we'll like them or shit on them. I think there's a slow, horrifying realization going on among Americans that it's actually the reverse. America is the weird social experiment that is rapidly fraying. Everyone else had their shit together for thousands. This was proven. This was a durable model for thousands of years. There's some history and heritage and depth to it that America does not lack. So immediately when Americans start to question their Americanness, they immediately go overseas to try to find it.
Right.
It's this instinct that I think we all share, and I think this is common to all people. I think Americans have just been encouraged to dissociate and disparage that connection to history. Maybe it's the collective immigrant history nature of Americans who have come to build this country to be what it is. But I want to start being more critical about what makes us Americans, in other words, because I don't think it's a, and even the POC writing is pretty weak in that regard. There is no critique of the American way of life. There's no critique of the ideology. There's only a critique of how the difference between that ideal and us is managed.
But that
that can either be celebrated. That difference can be either hyper celebrated. You see that in these like separatist. These hyper-separatist people, you know, it's usually when they first get fired up and they get, like, super jazzed. And they're like, we need to, like, run to the woods and make a compound.
I mean, like, Odinists and you know, stuff like
yeah,
that. And,
yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's relatively rare. But I think that they're operating off of a intense feeling of what other people may experience in a more mild but all-encompassing manner. And I think if you look at white people, they lost their connection to Europe at some point. And they were sort of clean slated. They were wiped clear. And I think a lot of what I see with Asian Americans is sort of wishing that that would happen to us as well. Could we, you know, I think the earlier era was, how do we clean slate ourselves? How do we wipe those memories clear? Yeah.
It seemed like, how do we, it seemed like to me the ideals, how do we become like Jewish Americans? How do we become like an ethnic group that still has a few little cultural like peccadilloes to fall back on to make us interesting more than just, you know, the typical white bread American. Yet
you're talking about Reform Jews.
Yeah. Not the ones who can't use their phones on the weekend or whatever. No, I have a friend who is that a good friend. It made like hanging out in college quite hard.
But I find that more interesting in a way. Right. Actually, because there are a lot of Jews in America who maintain very strong connections to both their faith and also to Israel. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of that's loaded politics and stuff, but I understand that myself. Mm-hmm. And
with respect to the white Americans trying to reach back to Europe, like forget Europe. I think some of them are just trying to reach back to America itself.
To America itself, yeah.
Which
yeah.
I think explains a lot of the disproportionate Reddit/online outrage about Hong Kong. Do you guys want to go there? We can like talk about that. All right, but before we go there, this is a kind of convoluted personal story, but I swear it'll link. And Tien, you talked about getting more personal. So here's a personal story I have to share. So at the end of the summer, I broke up with my girlfriend. We split ways. And she was the first Asian woman whom I've ever dated or been in a serious relationship with whom I could talk very frankly about these types of Asian American issues that we talk about on Plan A and everything. And it felt really, really good. It's something that I now learn is something that I want to idealize in a relationship. Whereas before, maybe 10 years ago, I might have been like, no, I don't want to talk about that shit. I want to be with someone who makes me forget about all that stuff, you know. But also that comes with, when you get so deeply invested in that, you do open yourself up to more just stress, you know, in general, because you're worrying about a lot more things. And what I found is, you know, it's been almost 2 months since we've parted ways. And I don't know if it's just a coincidence, but it also has been that time when I've pulled back a little bit more from Plan A. And I am wondering, is it because I'm no longer currently in such a relationship where I feel so invested in just Asian American stuff because I don't have a partner who is like that? And there is a temptation to just say, you know what? I just want to step away. I want to buy into this, you know, kind of post-racial ideal where you can just, with that kind of Hong Kong shit, having to, I think if you are a very race conscious Asian American, you have this difficulty where you realize on one hand there is stuff going on there that's legit, you know, China does do some horrible shit that, you know, we should all be aware of and stuff. Yet on the other hand, the clear bias that a lot of white Americans have in focusing so much on this one thing. When there's right now, there's the yellow vest stuff going on in France, in Haiti, there's this government corruption thing going on, Chile, this energy headquarters just burned to the ground because of protesters who were, I think, protesting a fuel, either it was end
austerity,
of fuel subsidies.
Austerity measures.
Yeah, I think they ended fuel subsidies or they put on a fuel tax. Lebanon, all sorts of shit going
Haiti.
On. In Lebanon, apparently the government tried to put a tax on using WhatsApp, and that was the last straw. They're like, okay, the economy is so bad right now. This is just the last straw. Ecuador, which has kind of calmed down a bit, but you mentioned Haiti. Where else?
Puerto Rico.
Spain. Mm-hmm. That. So much stuff going on. Kashmir with the Indian government cracking down there. There's all sorts of things going on, but why are these people so focused on Hong Kong? And they will probably, they claim it's for freedom and whatever, but it's obvious that it's really about them having their feelings hurt because they now think that, they're fans of the NBA or something. Now they think China's going to control their favorite league or whatever. So it's not really about freedom. It's secondary, maybe tertiary. But what it's really about is their own interest, right? And when you look at the history of just yellow peril and all that, and you know, hey, Japan in the 80s, that was a democratic ally country that didn't really stop, you know, that didn't save Vincent Chin's life or any of the other. You watch any of the movies from the 80s, all the heavy, anti-Japan yellow peril kind of stuff. So as an Asian American who is really bought into Asian America, that's the kind of stuff you feel torn by. It's how do I navigate that? Whereas if you just say, you know what, I'm just gonna opt out, just be so-called American, then you're in a much easier position where you can say just take, you know, toe the mainstream line.
I mean I tweet about this a lot, about Hong Kong and stuff, but I should be clear, and I think maybe it goes to answering a little bit what you're saying. I mean, the reason that I really do care about the way America... I don't really care about what's going on in Hong Kong, per se, because it's I don't live there. I care about how Americans talk about it.
Right, and exactly.
I care about how Americans talk about
xenophobia. Because that's the only thing we can't talk. That's like our jurisdiction. Like we, I don't know anything about in Hong Kong.
But
that's
why?
Like
but, I think, and I've really thought about why it bothers me a lot. And it's not because, like, for example, that I worry about China. China's a big boy. Like, it doesn't need our protection, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not even really worried that we're going to go to war with China or what. I don't think we are. If you really think about why this is being said. A lot of it is because you know that throwing shit against that wall won't lead to a real thing, right?
I actually do think so, but we talked about that before. But yeah,
I think the reason that I care about it is because it's not so much about Asian interests as it is, this is America. This is the country we live in. And every time I see Americans doing this, and I felt the same way, I felt the same level of annoyance when Russiagate was going on and everything was like, you're a Russian spy. I'm like, we can be better than this. We should be better than this as an American. So I think to the extent you're saying, do I care about Asian stuff or do I just become an American like everyone else and not give a shit? No, I think that there's no contradiction there. I think to be an American, you have to understand that like this is not good for our country. Right. So I do think there's something deeply patriotic or not patriotic, but like being American in it.
Yeah.
To be critical from your vantage point as an Asian who gets it. It's not because that I'm Asian that it's wrong to me. The tendency for a country to blame all of its problems on an external foreign enemy is the basis of fascist states. So we should not do that.
I think that's exactly right. I mean, we were talking about how to maybe... doing a pod on loyalty. That's a dense topic, but yeah. I mean, this kind of gets to that, right? This question, the way I have to think of it is, look, it wouldn't be bad to move back to Korea or something, right? It's not a bad, place. I would enjoy it quite a bit. There is something that keeps me here, and that's because I am an American, right? I had no control over that, but here I am, and I'm okay with it for the most part. So it's like this little tension that we feel as Asian Americans, like feeling excluded, or not quite this, not quite that, doesn't quite have as much relevance to me. It's just not a question to me. Like, I just am American.
Yeah, that's right. But because as an American, you can, to some extent, impose your view of what that means or what you want it to mean.
Yes.
Into America.
Yes. It's
how effective you'll be.
Being Asian makes me a better American,
right?
In my opinion.
That's right.
And in my view, a lot more of America would be better if they could take this point of view more seriously.
Yeah, because
saying what I do, it's not to bash America and say America's an evil country. It is, but it's not necessarily to distance myself from America. It's I am saying this as an American. This would be the kind of America I would like to see.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it's the question of loyalty or patriotism is a foregone conclusion. It's not by saying like I'm thinking out whether to stay here or just sign up and be a spy for China. That's not in the books. I'm writing this because I'm an American and I care about this shit as an American.
Yeah, and I think a lot of the contradiction comes from here, not from say as a Chinese American from China, where I don't think people in China view America with that same level of hostility, and they don't see the contradiction between of being, say, Chinese American, which mm-hmm. is why so many of them want to come here. They don't intend to lose their Chineseness by coming here. It's here. I think it's in America where we start drawing these lines. And I think a lot of groups in the past have tried to open that up and say, there's no need for that contradiction. I don't see why we're any different from them.
Yeah, I just want to read some tweets and Reddits regarding American reactions to Hong Kong, which I think highlight just how untrustworthy and full of shit like the average American online reaction to this is. So this is these are replies to a Melissa Chan tweet in which she said, between LeBron and Kerr, you've got some pretty well-known social justice sports guys whose social justice begins in America but ends at communist China's doorstep, or put another way, willing to give Americans a hard time but not any Chinese.
I thought
it was a pretty blatant dog whistle saying like giving Americans a hard time but not any Chinese is basically saying these black guys are only criticizing white Americans, but mm-hmm. not yellow people. So
who fucking shoots them dead?
Here are some of the tweets. Yeah. One guy, this guy, Michael Lipford. one of the tenets of multiculturalism is that the only culture you can criticize is Western culture. So, you know, that's a very predictable response. This, you dog whistle like that. Of course, that's what you're going to get. Here's another one that I found very... okay. This is from A. Edwards. Cognitive dissonance. They feel comfortable criticizing the Chinese because from their perspective, if you are not white, then you are marginalized regardless of where you are in the world and what demographics run your country. And then here's a few Reddit posts. Let's see.
Why the fuck should an NBA... Why should LeBron care about Hong Kong? Why is it somehow like white people trying... like? Just shitting on LeBron. I almost feel like it's their one chance because of this weird Chinese factor that lets white people shit on LeBron about something related to social justice.
Yeah. This is
just makes them fucking feel
like,
good.
I do believe that, like, this is like an America self-esteem thing. Like, America's self-esteem is very low right now, and the U.S. men's soccer team lost to Canada. It doesn't help. But, but here's a perfect example. So this guy, they're talking about, I think this was when the House passed the Hong Kong Freedom Bill or whatever. One guy writes, it's easy. Republicans like it because it challenges a communist state. Democrats love it because it is pro-democratic. Some guy replies, that's some wholesome bipartisanship I can get behind. Another guy replies, who knew that there was an issue so widely hated that we could get the gang to work together? Another guy replies, there isn't much in this world that's as impactful as America as a whole working together. Another guy replies, if only we could see it more often.
Yeah. It feels good. Yeah. Doesn't it feel good, I think, for a white person, white American, to finally not have to self-criticize and not have to shit on themselves? Like Matt Stone and Trey Parker. I mean, you got to give them a little bit of credit in the sense that South Park has skewered fucking white middle class Americans forever. Mm-hmm. Doesn't it kind of feel good for them probably to just be able to shit on another race of people, not white people, and not have to feel white guilt about it?
Yeah.
It must feel fucking liberating as hell to do that.
Yeah, with the NBA stuff, I do get a feel. And I do believe that these a lot of these people are probably good intentioned. Because like our NBA, like, it is a sub I generally like. They love Jeremy Lin. They love Yao Ming.
Yeah, I don't think they're racist in that sense.
It's not racist.
And they love Japanese shit. I don't think they're
like, I think it's too easy to say, oh, they're just being racist. That's a trap.
Plus, technically, they're being pro HK protester who are themselves.
Right. But then, okay, yeah. So I grew up in Vancouver, where a lot of the Chinese immigrants, when I was growing up, were from Hong Kong. It was a derogatory term used against them. We call it, well, no, I didn't call them, but other people call them hongers. To be a honger was you wore your hair in a weird like anime style. You, instead of listening to good old white bands like, I don't know, Nickelback or Pink Nickelback, you listen to J-pop. That was a honger. I'm just wondering how many of these same white people are now free Hong Kong. You know, that kind of bullshit. But I was going with... I think a lot of what really sort of rankles these people is that, hey, LeBron, we stood up for you when we went up against our own people, in other words, white cops. I don't think they like those cops, but I do think they see them as part of like an extended family. Maybe you're embarrassed of that family, but they're family nevertheless. I'm sure they even have cops, actually, in their literal family. We stood up with you when you attacked them. You're not standing up with us when, you know, it's kind of like our geopolitical enemy, let's face it, at this time. You know, so like, we were there for you. Why aren't you there for us? So there is this sense that you owe us. In the same way, and it's kind of like a quid pro quo. It's not really about
I don't think there's a quid pro quo to be had about standing up to like police violence. Mm-hmm. Like, how is that a quid pro quo?
Like, right, else, but you know, in like, their view, like,
They're somehow like in the black because they said
no, exactly.
One, you know, something that
I think that's how people at a fundamental level kind of think, like, hey,
no, I agree.
With you, why aren't you with us?
Yeah. I guess I would like going forward to not give a shit what other people think. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Like,
agreed.
I think that the past 2 years we have spent a lot of time analyzing how other people think and how what our position is, and I think it's valuable to at least know what your position is within the greater whole and how people will interpret what you say or why they say the things they say. But I want to see like a more aggressive projection of what we think versus How do we understand what, you know, we should just be putting our understanding of stuff out there. I'd like to see more of that. Just more assertiveness.
I just want to read this one more Reddit post. This is with respect to LeBron. This statement of his totally shows his lack of education and ignorance on the matter.
Oh,
the folks of Hong Kong are dying for their right to vote.
No, they're not.
And their freedom from an oppressed regime. I guess from an oppressive regime. If you're going to call China the oppressed regime, that doesn't make sense. This regime is just as akin to the slave traders or those who owned the cotton fields in the 1600s and 1700s.
See, there you go.
Civil war was fought for the freedoms of African Americans. Blood spilled for the freedom of speech, yada, yada, yada. So what's the subtext or text there?
You like, owe
you,
us.
You ungrateful blacks, we bled for you.
We freed you.
And in fact, us like white slavers, we weren't that bad because this communist China just as bad as us. So
yeah.
No,
so this isn't going anywhere,
by the way. I mean, I think what I've seen is black people see right through this shit immediately. See, they don't care about China. Why would they care? And to the extent that like a James Harden or like a LeBron James has a lot of exposure in China, they like it there.
Yeah, they get a ton of money.
People love me here.
They get a lot of
fans.
And
they don't yell at me the way white people in America or all Americans feel comfortable just shitting on them as if they're not really like full human beings. So,
see,
that's why Harden to me was like, yeah, I'm not saying anything because I fucking like China. I like riding around my scooter in China.
Taking a step way back, I recently saw like Captain America.
The movie. The first one, you mean?
Yeah, just I had no interest.
I've never seen it. So please describe.
I think I understand the appeal of stuff like this. America hasn't had a great fight in a very long time, right? So I think we can talk about this as nationalism, ethno-nationalism, all of that. But I think if you take a step back, I do think as a collective, America does have a malaise of the soul.
Yeah, exactly.
Like our cities are crumbling. We're unhealthy. We're dying. We're sick. We're anxious, right? That slogan, "Make America Great Again," it just has this appeal to it.
Or,
I don't like Trump, of course, but that like "Make America Great Again," I immediately knew what that was supposed to be. There was absolutely a heyday for Americans to be able to say like America, this is what we stood for. This is who we are as a people. Behold our works and tremble, right? So I think stuff like this just gave people a little way to access probably, you know, what common sentiment must have been, you know, a shadow of what must have been happening when America was fighting the Nazis.
Right, right. And forget about the MAGA people. Even take your, you know, pretty conscientious young white dude, you know, who like votes Democratic and stuff. They probably feel like you know what, we...
It's still a
malaise. Our best days are kind of behind us. All we do is get blamed for everything, and I gotta go along with it because you know what? I kind of know that we deserve it, but
nothing's gonna get better. It's kind of just all the same. Hillary, Trump. What's the real difference?
And then now comes China, and they're fucking banning Quentin Tarantino. Oh no! Like this is our fight now, and you can see where that emotion comes from. It's not illogical that they think that way, but let's recognize it for what it is. Let's not, you know, for all that, you know, Hong Kong's legit grievances is, let's not then excuse, you know, like foreign total self-interest in manipulating those people. Because I saw this Reddit thread where they were talking about that Hong Kong bill and how it would take away special status and that would actually economically devastate Hong Kong. I don't know if that's true or not, but let's just assume it's true. All the people there assumed it's true, and I saw absolutely no concern for the people, what would happen to people there. All they cared about was, ooh, this is going to show China. That's all they could get off on. And there was no concern for the people. The same people they claim are you know, fighting and dying for their freedom gave absolutely no shits about them. So this is all about their ego.
It's about an identity crisis, I think. In America. It says more about Americans than about any, like, who gives a shit about what they say about anyone else? The intensity of this one little, like, tempest in a, geopolitically speaking, a tempest in a teacup, right, is very telling of what Americans are hungry for. I actually see a slight glimmer of a silver lining in this. If people are aware that this is actually what they are itching for, right? Like this honest fight to improve, you know, their positioning, their status, whatever. If you turn it inward, you know, this is actually the seed of political sentiment.
I mean, I think that's happening, but I think it's happening in a bifurcated way, and I don't think we're going to escape there being. I think we're heading towards a major political conflict internally.
Yes,
in the U.S.
I think so.
I think the future is going to be divided between, you know, increasingly polarized factions. I don't know if it's just going to be two, but
the future in America, I don't think is, we're not going to come together. We're going to come together, but in various extremes, in various poles. And I don't think as Asian, we can, as Asians, like, we can necessarily avoid that. And so I think it's kind of, maybe what I'm interested in going forward is more along the lines, again, of that, of the alt-right article, which is kind of reading the political tea leaves a little bit and saying that, you know, you can't, there is no option for you to, because I think if there was, we would all do it. There is no option for you to just be like, you know, I don't have to care about these issues. I can just live my life in peace. Like, why would I care about this stuff? Well, there's a reason that at the end of the day, I ended up hanging out with you all and everyone else talking about this shit. It wasn't because it was a purely, you know, extracurricular interest of mine. I never gave a shit about this stuff before. I was forced to give a shit about it.
Yeah,
I think it's just going to keep happening.
It takes, it's claiming more and more people, right?
Mm-hmm. And there's no center to hold. You can't choose to not pick a side anymore.
Yeah.
So
there is no neutral ground, right? It's like, I feel like there's always a psychological middle ground for Americans, which is roughly pegged to class. It's roughly a middle class sensibility. It's a pretty broad one. I think that was America's claim to global power, is the power of its middle class. This thing that America was able to produce for a great number of its citizens that no other global economy could offer. That was a pretty powerful statement. We see that one shrinking. I don't think it's a coincidence. You see the middle class shrinking. You see people getting pushed to the precipice. And people are going nuts trying to maintain middle class status.
Yeah, that's right.
It's insane how everything might be going fine.
They're falling out every day.
You look at their balance sheets, and people are studying this every day. People are falling out of the middle. They've already fallen out. They are now deeply in debt to try to maintain just the impression of being in the middle class.
Yeah.
So in that sense, like, there is no one who is safe from this shit. Your job might be next. Your position in society is more precarious than you might think. And I think there's a general anxiety, because we're all kind of aware of it, more or less. You might think this is kind of an intellectual exercise, but the reason you're thinking about it the reason you're paying any attention to it at all is that you kind of know that this is real.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't.
Well, we are like an hour 15. Should we wrap it up or?
Yeah, I think
I feel better, so I'm done.
Yeah, I feel better.
Yeah. The most important.
Yeah.
Part. Yeah.
Like, now I just dumped it on you guys, so, you know, peace.
Actually, this den is not that cold, though. I don't know if it's because we.
It's not that cold today. I think temperature wise, it's not that cold.
It's really great talking about the state of the world in like this isolated cabin with
these beautiful leaves,
trees.
Trees, yeah.
This is like, really nice place. Yeah, just you guys go and fight it out. We're hanging. You guys just tell us how it goes.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Well, it was good to talk about it with you fine people, and this, I just feel so good because we were all in the same room, and yeah, I wish it becomes more regular, but I guess that's not up for us to decide. It's for the fates, right?
Yeah, I think you guys are gonna come to California. Isn't New York?
We should.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean permanently or to visit?
I don't know. It depends on how global warming goes.
Oh yeah. But aren't you more trouble if that happens than us? Well, no, we got the floods, but you got the fires.
I'm in the mountains.
Okay.
You'll be okay. just come find me. Don't go to the beach cities. Yeah. Those are terrible.
All right. Well, thanks for being with us, and thanks for listeners joining. We'll be back next week with another episode. This is Oxford Teen and Jess signing off. Bye, all.
See ya.
See ya.